Good evening. We're so many. This is wonderful. Very nice to see you all, long gone ones and brand new ones, and this is lovely. Let's do introductions all around.
I'm Britt. Me too.
Lauren.
Wendy.
Dan.
Forrest.
Jorge.
Samuel.
Shelley.
Jane.
Colin.
Julian.
Ron.
I'm Andy. Well, Forrest. Lauren. Even Jane. It's so good to see you. And Jorge, it's been a long, long time.
I'm glad to be here now.
Shelley, how did you hear about us?
I first came here 10 years ago in 1999. But I never stay. I come, I stay for a bit, and I go away. So this is very different. Thank you for your love tonight when I arrived, because last time our chairs were facing toward the center.
Oh, yes, they were.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Oh, my gosh. Well, welcome back.
Thank you.
And, Ron, you've been here before?
I came to the door once, but there was no meeting that night.
Ah. Oh, well.
So I knew where it was.
Yes. And how did you hear about it?
Surfing the web from City Center's web page and sort of following the web page off now.
Yeah. Have you been practicing up there?
A little bit. I practiced at City Center many years ago.
Uh-huh.
Mainly in that lineage for many years.
Well, welcome. That's our cousin, I always think. Their lineage is the cousin to our lineage.
Yeah.
It always is around Coben. And you? I've forgotten your name already. Nick.
Friend of mine,
I see. Welcome. Well, what we're doing is reading in this book, which is the teaching of Dogen Zenji, who taught many hundreds of years ago in Japan. And these are instructions to his monks. And I suspect they're pretty beginning monks, because it's pretty encouraging words. It's called Records of Things Heard. Kind of a funny title. But the kind of instruction he gives are kind of to encourage the monks who have given up everything to come and live in the monastery and do zazen. So it's not entirely applicable to our situation. None of us is in a monastery at this point. And the kinds of problems that we have don't look like the problems that he's talking about. But as we look more carefully, we begin to see how it can be easily applied to how we live also. So what we do is pass the book around and read a paragraph each until we've come to the end of each little section. And we're on page, we're in the third book, and we're on page 57, number 4. Want to begin? good.
In an evening talk, he said, "People who study the way must be utterly poor. As I see the people of the world, for those who have wealth, the two problems of anger and shame are sure to arise."
When one has a treasure, when he thinks that others will steal it, and he determines that it will not be taken from him, anger suddenly arises. Or perhaps in discussing this, when it comes to dialogue and settlement, eventually it creates a conflict, and they engage in battle. While it goes on this way, anger rises, and disgrace too befalls.
When one is poor and covets nothing, he has already avoided these problems and is free and at ease. The proof is right before your eyes. Don't wait to find it in the scriptures.
What is more, the ancient sages and past worthies criticized it, and all the gods, the Buddhas, and patriarchs all put it to shame when foolish people nevertheless store up property and treasure and embosom so much anger and hatred. This is the shame of shames.
To be poor, yet think of the way, is what the past worthies and ancient sages look up to. It is that over which all the Buddhas and patriarchs rejoice.
The degeneration of Buddhism in recent times is right before our eyes. From the time I first entered and saw Kenan Temple till the time when I saw it 7 or 8 years later, the things that had gradually changed were that they had put lacquered storage chests in each room, and each individual had his own utensils. Taking a liking to fine clothing, they accumulated material possessions and indulged in rude talk. By reflecting upon the decline of such things as salutation and ceremonial
obeisance.
The state of other places can be inferred from this.
Buddhists should not possess anything at all besides robes and bowl. What is there to put in it that one might need to make a lacquered chest? One should not have so much that he hides it from others. It is just because of fear of thieves that one thinks of hiding things away. If one abandons them and does not hold on to them, he will then be at ease. It is only when one thinks he will not be killed by others, even though he must kill them, that the body suffers and the mind is worried. If one has determined that even if people kill him, he will not retaliate, then one's mind is not worried and he does not trouble about thieves. One will never be ill at ease.
Actually, this is pretty timely. it's amazingly timely. I think it's the questions that come up around the subject of treasure and wealth, owning and holding things, having things. It's central to our culture and to our condition right now. I think everyone is asking these questions or having opinions about it. And there's a shift. There's some kind of change in many people's minds about values. Since we're not monks, of course, we can't be completely poor. We have to support our families. There isn't anybody who's going to cook for us or buy our food. Or make a home for us. We make our homes. We're like, I'm reading a book about insects, and I think we're like the bugs in a way. We each make our little home and go out and take care of ourselves. And if we're social animals, then we take care of each other as well, like the ants and the bees. And we have systems of doing that. What trouble he's pointing to really isn't the social situation as much as it is the mind of us, the attitude and the intention that we carry. If it's for getting and spending, as Wordsworth said, we lay waste our hours. So it's about how we hold ownership. We talk about non-attachment a lot in Zen. It becomes a kind of password. But in terms of poor or rich, it isn't so much what we have, is how we have it. There are some people who keep adding and adding and adding to what they have, and it's never enough. And some people who give away over and over and over again. The thing I most remember about Jikoji and often say is that when we began and all through the years that I was there, we almost never had enough. We were always just about to go out of money completely. And yet, as soon as we got really desperate, money came. Something came. Came from many different directions. There would be no predicting it at all. And then, of course, something would happen. The septic tank would break, or the roof would leak, or something that we had to take care of right away. And so we'd be back to the beginning again. And some people were very nervous about that and thought it was an unhealthy way to live, but it always seemed to me like it was the most healthy way to live. In a way, it required deep trust, and it meant that we re-examined what we were doing carefully to make sure that we weren't off in some way. Because it seemed to me like if you go off of your intention in some way, get a little too greedy, the things start going funny. They don't work so well. So it was a wonderful practice situation to keep the whole thing going year after year. And slowly, slowly, it meant that we developed it very, very, very slowly. It was a falling down place for so many years. But it meant that it was healthy. It was doing no harm. In our culture, we don't have such big emphasis on giving or giving away. There's some cultures where it's bred into everyone. Someone sees something in your house and you give it to them if they like it. It's just natural. It's completely natural. Or in the old potlatch up in the Northwest, where if someone accumulated an awful lot, he was expected to have a party and give it all away and start over. Nowadays, many people are having to do that, whether they want to or not. But it's as well as a sad and very difficult situation, it's also bracing in a way. We have to look more carefully, see how it is that we're doing, what is our intention. We can be poor in spirit without giving up our house and home. But the lacquered chests I really like that he went back to his old monastery, his very old temple, and there it was. They'd gussied the whole place up and got all fancy. And he was so disappointed and so incensed. How could they do that? It's so natural. It's so easy. When I look through the catalogs that come from Japan that have all the things like this, all the zenny accoutrements for the temples and the priests, and they have rakasus that are huge and golden and brocaded. They have robes that have phoenixes brocaded on the back, or whole forests, and they're beautiful, just incredibly beautiful. But you think, wait a minute, they're very, very expensive, thousands of dollars. But you can get into it like anything else. It's a mind trip. And Zen can do it too. So try to add just a little extra thing here and a little extra thing there, and pretty soon you have golden bowls and painted chests, and you hide your stuff in it. So it's a very nice story. So, are there questions? Comments? Dan?
Yeah, I was just thinking about the black lacquered cabinets as well, and I was thinking that our minds themselves can be black lacquered cabinets holding what we think is something of our own.
Special.
Yeah. And yet, it's contrived. It's as fancy a black lacquer as you want to make it, and you're working real hard to make it real fancy.
Yes. That's true. Thank you.
I lived in Taiwan for a couple of years and tried to be vegetarian, so I used to go to a lot of the vegetarian restaurants. Some were poor, you'd see a lot of monks there, and some were eating quite a bit, but plain. Some were very rich, and we had a golden Buddha statue in the foyer, and the patrons were rich, and the monks were from wealthy orders. So it all had to do with an established kind of church or religion that we don't really have here, but it's really spread out on a small scale. So the value must be in relation to something. We decide.
Yes.
Some economist in the LA Times a couple of weeks ago estimated that the total value of the all the money that seems to have disappeared was 2.4 quadrillion. Which is
it's a dream.
10 times what U.S. economists were estimating, and even part of that is 10 times more than the world produces in 1 year. So I've kind of thought about that. What is value in terms of money?
It's arbitrary.
It's arbitrary that we assign.
And that's what it's coming down to. We're living in this dream, really, with the value everyone thought they understood. But people tweaked it so much and played around with it so much that the whole thing lost value entirely. Something to do with trust, I think. Julian?
I think the motivations for making things more complicated vary so much.
Yeah.
And I think the tendency to complicate things won't go away until someone is able to stare that real motivation, like stare it down, so to speak, or just be with that. What underlies it?
Which is self-enhancement often. Bucking oneself up, one's own identity up, even, you know, to be a more important person.
Sometimes it can be actually sad, too.
Yes.
Like someone trying to show their worthiness.
Yes.
To somebody else. And it may not be like this kind of, I don't know, may not necessarily be aggressive, and maybe bring up something very tender, actually.
Yes. Yes, but it's a misunderstanding. That's the basis of it. It's the misunderstanding about who they are. But it's also creative. We're all very creative. You know, why have something plain when you can fancy it up? And then, you know, somebody really creative just sort of goes in and makes something even more. It's hard to keep it back on the ground again. I always think meeting here in the Quaker Meeting House is such a wonderful teaching for us, because they keep coming back to the ground over and over again, and don't, at least their ideal is not to create hierarchies and anything fancy at all. The next one is the same subject, and I think it would be a pity not to read it at the same time. It's shorter. Whose turn is it? Sanya's. 58.
One day he said, when the Zen... this right?
Mm-hmm.
When the Zen master Chaimin was great elder at the Ten Tong, there was a monk in his congregation known as Senior Yon. This man was one who had grasped the truth and awakened to the way. His practice and attainment excel
even that of the other. One night he went to the abbot's quarters, burned incense, bowed, and said, please allow me the head seat of the rear hall.
At that time the Zen master wept and said, since the time I was a novice, I have never heard such a thing as this. For you, a meditating monk, to seek the head seat or the position of great elder is a serious mistake. You have already awakened to the way better than I have, but is your seeking for the head seat for the sake of advancement? If I were to allow you, you could be allowed even the front hall or the position of great elder. Your attitude is base and ignoble. From this indeed can be inferred that of the other monks who are not yet enlightened. The decline of the Buddhist teaching can be known by this. So saying, he shed tears and wept sadly.
Although he deferred in shame at this, still eventually he was asked to occupy the head seat. Afterwards, the senior Yang reported this talk, shaming himself and bringing his teacher's excellent words to light. As I consider this, the ancients thought it shameful to seek advancement or to want to be the head of something or to be the great elder. Just think of awakening to the path. There should be nothing else of concern.
So again, it's about attitude and about ambition. And it's very easy in this kind of monastic setting to become ambitious and want to better oneself as if there were a better. It makes me think that, I can't quite remember where it was, maybe it was in Taos. I was talking to one of Koban's senior students who, like me, had received an okesa from him. And I was telling the story of how, although he asked me to sew it, he asked me to give it to him when I was finished, which I did. And then I kind of forgot about it. And suddenly, at a sesshin, with no warning at all, he presented it. And it wasn't even a ceremony. He just put it on my head, and we did the rope chant 3 times, and then he put it on me. And as we walked out the door, he said, "Now, I want you to understand that this is not your robe." He said, "If somebody comes visiting from Japan and they forgot their okesa, you can let them wear it." So I didn't even wear it for a couple of years. I was scared of it. There's this thing. And I talked to my friend, and he said, "Oh, the same thing happened to me. That's just what Koban told me too. Said, it's not your road." Of course it's not. But you begin to, you know, in any situation, if you're not real discriminating about how your mind is working, you just dip into those ways of those attitudes. Oh, I could do better. I could have the high seat. It was a wonderful, wonderful teaching. And I heard later a story about a great master in Thailand, actually, who was riding on a train through the countryside, and at every stop he would stand out on the balcony of the train and everyone would bow and bow. And finally someone with him said, "Aren't you kind of overwhelmed by all being bowed to all the time?" And he said, "They're not bowing to me, they're bowing to the robe." And that's what this fellow misunderstood. Practice is very subtle that way. Very discreet and very modest. And when ambition gets into it, it's not that it's bad, it's just muddy. Sometimes painfully muddy. All through the hundreds of years, thousands of years of Buddhism, they talk about the decline of the Buddhist teaching. And sometimes they talk about this is the last era and it's going downhill really fast and, well, it's gone. I think that's to keep everybody on their toes. If we thought it was really great, then we'd take it for granted. But if it's on decline, well, better. We've got some work to do here. Better pay attention. So I'm glad we had a chance to read that also. It seems to fit right in. Jane?
Negotiation we had to do that was, it felt like there's a lot riding on it, and I didn't feel prepared, so these two men were meeting with me in the conference room, and so I thought, okay, should I put the printouts in the places ahead of time, maybe I'll bring my laptop in here. Like I'm kind of like popping myself up.
Yeah.
Because I felt unprepared. And it just stops doing that, that it's, I just thought, okay, well, just heal itself. What else can you do?
Yeah.
But it's okay. I mean, that's why we do it, because you feel like you have to, and it's not enough.
Try to protect, you're protecting yourself.
Yeah. And I had other people's opinion of me in my head saying,
yes.
And how would they do it? I have no idea how they would do it, and maybe it would be more successful, or a different outcome would come from it. But it's what you do.
And sometimes we posture ourselves with the assumption that we know what other people are thinking. That's really undermines our way. It's because we don't know what other people are thinking.
That was part of the pressure of the situation, too.
Yeah.
There was a story that was being manufactured by others, and that we were all batting back and forth to each other. As the meeting progressed, we're all like physically tense. I watched it. But we physically relaxed, we leaned into the table, we were more natural in our gestures. And the truth, just the simplicity and the immediacy of being together in this room and the desire to understand together, it became clear. It was just the three of us working out in the room.
Congratulations. What a relief. Yeah.
I remember when I was a kid, like maybe four, I remember figuring it out that it doesn't work to tell lies because you got to remember them.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, that doesn't work. Can't do that. It's the same thing.
Forrest?
This passage, it kind of makes me laugh. It's kind of a joke, right? I mean, any time that I hear any story that is talking about, there's a master, but there's this other guy, and he's really got it. You know, this guy has got the way even better than the master. And then there he goes, the master.
Yes.
And then I think, okay, well, you know, come on. I laughed out loud when the master started crying. That's the way. It seems like a recurring theme in kind of this like storytelling to kind of get the point across. You know, say like, okay, here's this guy that's got it. Now watch what he does.
Yes, yes, right.
You have it.
It's like somebody who's pompous and slips on a banana peel.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's pretty funny.
And then the kind of the majesty of your awesomeness, you know, of the master of Christ, you know, who sheds tears.
Yes. Yes.
Really, really stick it to this guy.
Make him feel really bad.
And then gives him the seat after all.
Yes. Yes, that's the way it works, but not when he wants it. Yeah. Well, it's 8:00. That went very fast.